Welcome to the December 2016 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan or This Month in Other Journals besides the AJNR. As usual, I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've selected 8 articles from the recent literature that I found of some interest, and I hope you find them of interest as well. The first has a first author of Austin, and it's entitled Comparison of Perfusion CT Software to Predict the Final Infarct Volume After Thrombectomy. This is from Stroke in 2016. Now, the purpose of the study was to determine the accuracy of different commercial perfusion CT software packages to predict the final infarct volume after mechanical thrombectomy. Packages evaluated included the Philips Brain CT perfusion package from Philips Healthcare in the Netherlands, the Siemens Singo Volume Perfusion CT Neuro from Siemens Healthcare in Erlangen, and number 3, the RAPID system, which is iSchemaView Incorporated from Menlo Park, California. CTP data from 147 mechanically recanalized acute ischemic stroke patients were post-processed. Ischemic core and final infarct volume were compared about thrombolysis in cerebral infarction or TICI score and time interval to reperfusion. Final infarct volume was measured at follow-up imaging between days 1 and 8 after stroke. Significant differences were found between the packages about over and underestimation of the ischemic core, with RAPID best predicting hypoperfusion volume in non-successfully recanalized patients. They conclude that this software package overestimated the final infarct volume to a significantly lower degree and estimated a malignant mismatch profile less often than other software. All right, let's go on to number 2. This has a first author of TAN, and it is entitled Good Intracranial Collaterals, Trump, Poor Alberta Stroke Program Early CT Score for Intravenous Thrombolysis in Anterior Circulation Acute Ischemic Stroke. And this is from the journal Stroke from 2016. Now, it's a nice background and a reference. You might want to look at another paper describing the various collateral scoring systems. And that would be Yeo, Y-E-O, as a first author. And that's Assessment of Intracranial Collaterals on CT Angiography and an Anterior Circulation Acute Ischemic Stroke. That's from AJNR in 2015. Now, the authors for this paper evaluated the prognostic effect of the collateral circulation in patients with thrombolyzed acute ischemic stroke who have a large early infarct size as indicated by low aspects score. They stratified patients using aspects into 2 groups, large volume infarcts with an aspects less than or equal to 7 and small infarct volumes with aspects of 8 to 10. They also evaluated a third group with very large infarct volumes with an aspects of less than or equal to 5. The authors then evaluated the 3 subgroups using the MAAS, that's M-A-A-S, the TAN, T-A-N, and aspects collateral grading systems of the CTA intracranial collaterals. The TAN system targets collateral vessels in the MCA territory. The MAAS system compares the vessels from side to side, and the aspects collateral system subdivides the leptomeningeal collaterals into several more theoretically objective measurable areas. Good collaterals were defined as the following. In the MAAS system, leptomeningeal vessels were equal to or greater than the contralateral side, and the TAN system, greater than 50% of the MCA territory. For the aspects collateral system, good collaterals were defined as equal or more prominent when compared with a matching region in the opposite hemisphere, and poor collaterals as arteries not seen or less prominent compared with the contralateral side, to form a cumulative 20-point scale. So, after all was said and done, the bottom line, on a multivariate analysis, younger age and good collaterals by the aspects collateral system were associated with good outcomes. So, aspects wins the day on this one. Let's go on to number 3. This has a first author of Barajas, and this is the development of reduced diffusion following bevacizumab therapy identifies regions of recurrent disease in patients with high-grade glioma. This is from Academic Radiology in 2016. So in this paper, 26 patients treated with bevacizumab for high-grade glioma underwent lesion-wide ADC analysis before therapy and at the time of clinical and radiologic progression, allowing for stratification by the presence or absence of reduced diffusion. Lesions with reduced diffusions were classified into a block or a salt and pepper phenotype. 8 of the 26 patients underwent imaging-guided tissue sampling at the time of suspected disease recurrence, allowing for direct biological correlation. 62% of the cohort had developed reduced diffusion at clinical progression following bevacizumab. They conclude that following bevacizumab therapy, recurrent glioblastoma can manifest as non-enhancing regions characterized by reduced diffusion. Histologically, these MR imaging characteristics correlate with aggressive biologic features of disease recurrence. Now, current RANO criteria recommend that enlarging areas of mass like T2 hyperintensity should be considered as evidence of tumor progression. However, current RANO criteria do not account for the development of reduced diffusion following anti-angiogenic therapy. So this study, I think, help provides direct histologic evidence that the development of non-enhancing infiltrative T2 flare prolongation associated with reduced diffusion represents recurrent disease following that anti-angiogenic therapy. And there are 4 figures and 4 tables in this paper. All right, let's go on to number 4, as a first author of Clark. And this is entitled Safety and Efficacy of Vertebroplasty for Acute Painful Osteoporotic Fractures, acronym VAPOR, a multicenter randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And this is from Lancet in 2016. So until now, there has been no evidence that vertebroplasty was more effective than placebo in the treatment of acute painful osteoporotic vertebral fractures, most notably for those in the thoracolumbar region. And no mass studies have exclusively examined acute fractures of less than 6 weeks' duration. VAPOR was a multicenter randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial of vertebroplasty in 4 hospitals in Sydney, Australia. They recruited patients with 1 or 2 osteoporotic vertebral fractures of less than 6 weeks' duration. Vertebroplasty was done with the adequate vertebral fill technique and the placebo procedure with simulated vertebroplasty. So the placebo procedure was designed to simulate vertebroplasty and included subcutaneous lidocaine but not periosteal numbing. A short needle was passed into the skin incision, but not as far as the periosteum. Manual skin pressure and regular tapping on the needle was done, mimicking vertebroplasty needle advance. Conversation about PMMA mixing and injection suggested that vertebroplasty was being done. 61 patients were randomly assigned to vertebroplasty and 59 to placebo. Now, 24 or 44% of patients in the vertebroplasty group and 12 or 21% in the control group had a pain score below 4 out of 10 at 14 days. They conclude that vertebroplasty is superior to placebo intervention for pain reductions in patients with acute osteoporotic spinal fracture of less than 6 weeks' duration. So again, win one for vertebroplasty in this very specific group of acute osteoporotic fractures less than 6 weeks. All right, let's go on to number 5. This has a first author of Deva Sagriam, and it is entitled Cerebral Venous Sinus Thrombosis Incidence is Higher Than Previously Thought. And this is from Stroke from 2016. And I thought this was an interesting use of some big data that they got a hold of. So the incidence of cerebral venous thrombosis has been reported as being 2 to 5 cases per million per year. However, recent reports suggest a much higher incidence on the order of 13 million person years. So the purpose of this study was to try to determine the incidence of cerebral venous thrombosis in Adelaide, South Australia, by using a novel ascertainment methodology. So ICD discharge codes were searched to identify all patients with a potential diagnosis of cerebral venous thrombosis. All neuroimaging performed in public hospitals is entered into a central searchable data repository. They additionally searched all 259,000 or so neuroimaging studies performed between 2005 and 2011. The reports of these studies were searched for text variations containing the words venous and thromb, THROMB. A total of 168 cases were identified by the combined ICD and neuroimaging searches. Of the 105 cases confirmed, 59 were identified by both ICD and radiology database searches, and about 38% by radiology alone and 6% by ICD coding alone. Therefore, the radiology database search correctly found 94% of the cases. With 105 cases confirmed in the population of about 950,000 adults, they figured out an incidence of 15.7 cases per million per year. Not sure how much of interest the overall number is, but I thought the data analysis was interesting. All right, let's go on to number 6. Has a first author of Eklund, and this is called Cluster Failure: Why fMRI inferences for spatial extent have inflated false positive rates. And this is from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science from 2016. So functional MRI is about 25 years old, yet its most common statistical methods have not been validated using real data, according to the authors. So the authors used resting state fMRI data from 499 healthy controls to conduct 3 million task group analyses. Using this null data with different experimental designs, they estimate the incidence of significant results. In theory, they should have found about a 5% false positive for a significance threshold of 5%, but instead, they found that the most common software packages for fMRI analysis, SPM, FSL, and AFNI, can result in false positive rates of up to 70%. So they conclude that these results question the validity of many fMRI studies, upwards of 40,000 maybe, and may have a large impact on the interpretation of weakly significant neuroimaging results. So this points out a couple of recurring difficulties in published results in general, that of the overuse of the term significance as the ultimate judge of importance and validity, and of the general poor representation of reproducibility papers in the literature. All right, let's go on to number 7. This is the first author of Everson, and this is entitled Curie-1 Malformation in the Adult, and this is from Neurosurgery Quarterly in 2016. So this is a very nice review article on Curie-1 malformation, including history, nomenclature, symptoms, epidemiology, genetics, imaging, and treatment. Not the greatest quality MR images, but they end up making their point. The authors describe, to their minds, some specific variants of a relatively small posterior fossa, which can be further broken down into anterior, which would be encroachment of the posterior fossa by basilar invagination, odontoid invagination. The roof type, ROOF, which shows a low insertion of the tentorium onto the occipital, that is a low-lying torcula, resulting in an almost vertical tentorium which appears parallel to the clivus on the sagittal image. The floor type, FLOOR, which is a thickened occipital bone, horizontal occipital bone, or upward sloping posterior edge to the foramen magnum, and the mass type, MASS, which is a space-occupying lesion, such as arachnoid cyst or extraaxial tumor. So overall, a very interesting review article, and 12 figures included in this. Well, let's go on to the last paper, number 8, and that is the first author of Goodell. And this is called Human Dorsal Root Ganglion Perfusion Measured by in vivo MRI, and this was from NeuroImage in 2016. So I thought this paper was worth the read, if only for the explanatory neuroanatomy of the dorsal root ganglion, which I've sort of ignored and which is obviously much more complex than I'd realized. So in 46 normal subjects, a T1-weighted dynamic contrast-enhanced vibe sequence was acquired through the L5 ganglia level with the following sequence parameters, TRTE 3.3 and 1.1, flip angle of 15, 24 slices, and a resolution about 1.3 by 1.3 by 3 cubic millimeters. The contrast agent was Dotarem and was administered intravenously at the beginning of the third frame and at the standard concentration of 0.1 millimole with a flow rate of 3.5 mils per second. 24 frames were recorded at a rate of about 7.5 seconds per frame. A 15-channel receive and transmit spine coil and an 8-channel receive body flex coil were used. Transfer constant, K-trans, and interstitial volume fraction, which was interstitial leakage fraction, were modeled for the dorsal root ganglion and spinal nerve by applying the TOFS model. Statistical analysis included pairwise comparisons of L5-S1 dorsal root ganglion and the spinal nerve. Also, distinct physiologic zones within the S1 dorsal root ganglion were compared, the so-called cell-body-rich area versus the nerve-fiber-rich area. The dorsal root ganglion showed a significantly increased permeability compared to the spinal nerve, combined with an increased interstitial leakage of contrast agent into the extravascular and extracellular space. So they conclude that the non-invasive and in vivo measurement of human dorsal root ganglion by perfusion MR is a feasible technique. They speculate that the technique could become useful in future research on the poorly understood human sensory neuropathies and pain syndromes. So I thought interesting from a technical perspective and something to think about. Well, that's it for this month. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. Again, if you have feedback, either good or bad, just let me know, ajnr.eic@gmail.com. Till next time, have a fantastic holiday time, and I will hopefully talk to you next year. Thanks so much for listening.